John Kerry is looking confidently into the future, even as he looks back at his life of public service, which ranges from being the face of the Vietnam Veterans Against the War to a Democratic nominee for president and Secretary of State. Secretary Kerry writes about challenges facing the world, focusing on climate change, in the final chapter of his 600-page memoir titled Every Day is Extra. And even in the face of President Trump's opposition to climate action, John Kerry remains optimistic. He spent his youthful summers in and on the waters of Buzzards Bay in Massachusetts, which gave him a lifetime attachment to the sea. Over the decades, he's played key roles in legislation and international negotiations on climate change, acid rain, and ocean health. Secretary Kerry, welcome to Living on Earth.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
So, you know, if there's one thing from your book, Every Day is Extra, it is your love of the ocean. Why does the ocean call to you in such a strong way?
Well, I'm a son of Massachusetts. I think it calls to all of us, sons and daughters. We are blessed to be people of the sea here in the state of Massachusetts. And we love Cape Cod. We love the islands. And I learned as a kid, you know, I was raised down on the, around Buzzards Bay. And I used to just clam and fish and play in the water, learn how to sail, do all these wonderful things. But I learned about under the water. And I then was a big Philippe Cousteau fan and used to tune in. My mother was an enormous conservationist, environmentalist. And I grew up with a sense of responsibility, understanding that the ocean is fragile. It's not impervious to the things we humans do to it.
And as I recall from your book, in your fortunate childhood, you were on one of the Elizabeth Islands. You were on Naushon.
Yeah.
You come out of Woods Hole and you can see it on your way to Martha's Vineyard, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great place to have your toes in the sand as a kid.
Yeah, it's a gift beyond description. And it was wonderful to be able to be there. But I think that everywhere on our Cape, people would get to experience the beauty of our sand dunes, of our low tides, of the enormous beaches, the remarkable vision that President Kennedy had to create the Cape Cod Seashore National Monument. So we're very lucky people. And our history goes way back, obviously. I mean, everybody during the era of 1700s, 1800s, early 1600s came here on a boat. And we have always had a tie, our history, to the sea in our merchant efforts, the China trade.
The cod on top of the State House?
Cod, the whaling, and, you know, we don't have cod now. I mean, this ought to be a message to everybody. It's Cape Cod, but there are no cod, or there are very, very few and precious few. And it's a tragedy. If we don't start paying attention to how we manage these kinds of things, we could see an economic impact on our state.
So what do we need to do today to take care of our oceans?
I think there are three primary challenges. Number one, climate change, which is caused by greenhouse gases, which fall in the ocean and acidify the ocean, which has a negative impact on the growth of clams, crustaceans, shells, and bleaches out spawning grounds and coral reefs and so forth around the world. We don't know all the impacts. We know it has an impact. We don't know the rate of impact. We don't know where you could have a precipitous, catastrophic impact. And so that's why we owe it particular respect and concern. The second great impact is pollution, general pollution. People build, they build near the ocean. There's what we call non-source point pollution. You have runoff, you have gasoline runoff from stations, you have oil runoff, you have pesticide runoff, you have high nitrate runoff, which affects the level of oxygen in the water and therefore the fish and plants and fauna in the ocean. And we have 500 dead zones around the world in the oceans today, dead zones. Nothing grows because of what has happened with this overload. And also pollution generally. It affects the fish. You have plastic getting into marine mammals, into birds. I've seen film of sharks and or porpoises and or whales dragging nets around and dragging plastic around. It's crazy. And then finally, we have overfishing. We have too much money chasing too few fish. And that's one of the reasons we don't have any cod anymore here. Eight of the top fisheries of the world are now overfished, out of the sort of 18 or so fisheries, principal ones. And the others are at or near max. So with 450 million Chinese who've come out of poverty into the middle class, who now have discovered blue tuna and sushi, with 400 million Indians, likewise, and people around the world gaining in income and in therefore appetite, we have a huge challenge. And already about 12% of the protein that people get in the world comes from fish. So there's a huge demand for fish as a food stock. And increasingly, we're going to see pressure on that. So those are the biggies. But the pollution is just stunning. I mean, if we continue at the rate we're going, there will be more plastic than fish in the ocean in 20, 30 years.
Now, of course, you've had a storied career most recently as a diplomat, and your background, I think you spent some time in France and Switzerland as a kid, and your dad was a diplomat. But when it comes to the ocean, you've had some special concerns, and I just want to quickly ask you about two. One, there's something called the Law of the Sea Treaty,
right,
which is something that the United States and folks from Massachusetts like Elliot Richardson worked on years ago, which we've never ratified.
Right.
And now there's talk of having some sort of a high seas treaty. That would govern, what is it, half of the world is not in any jurisdiction?
Correct. It's called the high seas. And the high seas do not belong to any particular nation, but they get egregiously overfished by renegade fishers, pirate fishermen. And years ago, Senator Ted Stevens and I went to the United Nations to try to ban the drift net fishing. We succeeded. It was banned. But today, you have pirate fishermen, renegade fishermen, who go out with a drift net. And a drift net is literally thousands of miles of monofilament netting that they drop behind a boat, drag along. It kind of strip mines the ocean. And as much as two-thirds of the catch, certainly 50%, is called waste catch. They just throw it overboard. So it's changing the ecology of the ocean by, imagine the vision of a, you see a strip mine on coal or in the land, you see it just ravaging everything around it. This is what a drift net will do. And then sometimes it breaks off and it becomes what we call a ghost net because it just fishes on its own. When it's weighted down with carcasses, it sinks to the bottom, scavengers clean it off, it rises to the top again until it gets tangled in a whale or tangled in the propellers of some boat. It's a scourge. And we have no enforcement on those high seas, or very little enforcement, I should say. Occasionally, someone's military ship goes through it, and you can check on who's who and what's happening, and you can certainly mark what ships are there fishing.
So we're overfishing. Talk to me about the climate and your concerns about climate change.
We face a massive challenge of dealing with climate refugees. The prime minister of the Fiji Islands, I just met with him the other day, at an event in California where he pointed out that they're literally taking refugees from other islands. And they themselves are now planning how to move. Where can they go to be safe? They're going to lose their nation state, which is these islands. Increased fires, increased floods, more moisture in the air because of the warming of the ocean, more intensity in the storms because of that moisture. We're seeing it in the hurricanes we've seen. Last year, just three hurricanes, Harvey, Irma, and Maria, cost the taxpayer $265 billion. One-third of the Defense Department budget for a year. Think of that. Three storms. And it's going to get worse. So people who sit there and say, well, we can't afford to do something or we can't, that's crazy. It is far more expensive to do nothing or to do very little than to actually step up and try to deal with the problem of climate change. And why? Because the answer to the problem of climate change is energy, energy policy. We have the solutions. Solar today is less expensive than coal, but people are still using coal. We shouldn't be. We can't be using coal because it's the dirtiest fuel there is. And we've got to move off of coal onto the alternative renewables. They're there, and we need the leadership that does it. And regrettably, this president and his administration are not only not dealing with climate, but they're lifting the restrictions we have on air quality because of automobiles. They're lifting the restrictions we had on coal dust going into water, into rivers and lakes. They're putting it back. God knows, I don't know who the constituency is for this, but that's what they're doing. Well, you do know who the constituency is. It's coal companies and it's big corporations and so forth. And we have to fight back against it.
Your book, which you call Every Day is Extra, could almost be about the climate itself. that every day we wait to deal with it.
Well, it is about the climate. The last chapter of my book, which I'm very partial to, it's the wrap-up chapter, is called Protecting the Planet. And I deal with my efforts to get the Paris Agreement passed. I mean, I went to China, brought the Chinese into the agreement with us, because I watched the failure in Copenhagen 4 years earlier, where it fell apart because China was leading the less developed countries in a different direction. China and the United States were able to lead the world to make an agreement. That's what we have to get back to. Instead of, you know, bashing China every day with new sanctions. Now, there are problems with China's management of the market.
Of course.
I'm not ignoring that. I think there's a better way to deal with it than the current administration is.
So let's drill down on that. I believe over the years, I've seen you at just about every of the major climate conferences. What inspired you to think that you could find a way to cut a deal with the Chinese? Because between us and the Chinese, what, it's 40, almost 50% of the world's emissions.
Well, short of, just shy of 50. It's about 45, yeah.
Yeah. So what inspired you to think that there would be a way that you could get them to join us to do something?
I believe in logic. I believe in common sense. And I believe in the power of persuasion. And I believed that it was in China's interest. I mean, countries, it's hard to get countries to do things that they never perceive are in their interest. But I thought it was in their interest because I'd spent enough time working with lower-level Chinese bureaucrats on the subject of climate that I knew what they were thinking. And I knew they were hearing from their own constituencies. I mean, China is a one-party system. It's authoritarian, yes. But it's not immune to citizen opinion. And it's quite amazing, really, the way, in fact, it filters up through the mayors and the governors and into the ether of their politics. So I was hearing from people that Chinese were increasingly upset with the quality of their water. They were upset with the quality of their air. We were posting the daily air quality on the embassy in Beijing. And people were tuning in like crazy to our embassy to find out what the air quality was. And the Chinese didn't love it, but we did it. It had an impact. So they wanted to take care of their people. It's that simple. They really knew. But they did it because politically, it's survival. They knew it was important to their ability to be able to meet the people's interests, which is basic politics. We haven't been doing that in America, by the way. People's interests are not being met in our own country. And that's why our democracy is in trouble. That's a whole different diversion. I won't go there in this instance.
Well, but do go there.
Well, it has to do with whether we get things done on the environment, whether we hold people accountable to what's happening now. The fact is that I believe people, individuals, kids here at, you know, at UMass or at any college in this country are the key to being able to hold the politicians accountable. And you can't do it sitting on your butt and pretending somebody else is going to do it or it's not involved you. Everybody has to be involved in this. We have to go out and organize and make it a difference. Now, why do I say this with such conviction? I'll tell you why. Because we did it in 1970. In 1970, Rachel Carson had inspired many of us with the Silent Spring. We had the Woburn waste dump. We had toxic waste sites. We had a river, the Cuyahoga River in Ohio, would light on fire, literally. And people say, I don't want to live next to this. I don't want to get cancer from the water I drink. I don't want to get, you know, emphysema or heart disease from the air quality. So we brought 20 million Americans out of their homes on one single day, Earth Day, April 22nd, 1970. And we translated that into a political movement. We targeted the 12 worst votes in the United States Congress, House of Representatives. Seven of the 12 lost their seats in the 72 election. Guess what? Boom, we had the Clean Air Act passed, the Safe Drinking Water, the Marine Mammal Protection, the Coastal Zone Management. The EPA was created and Richard Nixon signed it into law. Why? Because it was a voting issue. That's what we have to do today, folks. There's no mystery to how we reclaim the direction and future of our country. It's by going out and working in our democracy. Make it work. Last time in 2016, when Trump was elected, 54.2% of eligible voters came out to vote. 54.2. When Barack Obama was elected in 2008, it was 62.3%. That's the difference. The story of what we have today is not the people who did vote, it's the people who didn't vote. And so I'm just saying to you, we can change this, but we have to do it now because the clock is ticking.
Let me ask you just to reflect on this for a moment. Looking at American history, in 1860, in the South, there was more monetary value in slaves than there was in the land. By 1865, that was a classic stranded asset. All that value disappeared. To what extent today do you think we're being held hostage by folks who think that all that fossil fuel in the ground, which is on balance sheets at billions and billions and billions of dollars, and it can't all be burned if we understand the science correctly, to what extent are we headed down a path? I mean, to solve the problem that we had with slavery, I mean, there's the moral question there, just like we have today with climate, as well as the economic question. To solve that problem, we wound up in a very bloody war.
Yeah, I don't think that's the choice for America now. I think most of the executives I know at the higher level of the oil industry are all diversifying. Shell, BP, they're all investing in new energy. They're ready to move where the market would go. And we're not going to be able to transition fast enough that you'd suddenly dry up and not have oil or gas involved. There's going to be oil and gas for a while. It's just the nature of the beast. We've got to try to guarantee it's not for too long. Why? I'm simply listening to the scientists. I mean, I'm listening to the and understanding the science. If we don't move off fossil fuels fast enough, we could reach what's called a tipping point, where things begin to cascade downwards in a spiral of destruction and dying, of dying seas, dying trees, dying species of various kinds, because it's not sustainable. And if you get into that kind of a spiral, nobody knows. Nobody can tell you how you break out of it. I'm just applying a precautionary principle to the idea of governing. I mean, we buy insurance to make sure if our home burned down, we're going to be able to rebuild it. We buy car insurance to fix the wreck and, you know, life insurance in event somebody lost a life. The family's okay. Why aren't we buying insurance against the death and destruction that will come with increased storms and increased climate change? It's beyond my understanding why we could have a president who is a denier of this science. 98% of all the scientists in the world who ever watched this and looked at it with peer-reviewed studies, all say this is happening now. And it's caused by, not exclusively, but largely by human beings. And if we don't respond to this, woe to us. I mean, then we're entering into a sort of suicide pact.
It could be worse than the United States Civil War, though.
Well, right now we are heading, the goal in Paris was to keep the rise of the Earth's temperature to 2 degrees centigrade. And we were going to try to excite enough nations to become involved that we could meet that standard. We now know at the current rate, we're not meeting that standard. We are heading now towards 4 degrees centigrade rise in the temperature, the average temperature of the planet. That's catastrophic. You will have water battles. You will have refugees moving. If you think we have tough migration challenges today, wait till people can't produce food in various parts of the world. Wait till their water dries up and they're not able to live. What happens when the oceans change and you have a migration away from certain stocks that people have relied on for food and so forth? There are just so many unknowns here. I'm not willing to just throw up my hands and say, oh, someone's going to take care of this, because that's just not responsible given the input.
Back in the day as Lieutenant Governor of Massachusetts, which is not exactly ordinarily a very exciting position, you made your mark jumping on the acid rain problem.
Right.
Tell me, what did that teach you about the politics of environmental protection?
That reasonable people with a reasonable purpose in public life are able to work together, Republican and Democrat, in order to do things that are good for American citizens. I was a lieutenant governor, but Michael Dukakis allowed me to be the chair of the governor's task force for him. I worked with Governor John Sununu of New Hampshire. I worked with Governor Dick Celeste of Ohio. And we put together, the three of us, an approach drawn up, by the way, by the American Enterprise Institute. It's a conservative approach to how you use the market to be able to accomplish something you want to accomplish. And there was a market incentive for people to actually buy and trade sulfur, which reduced the amount of sulfur. We got acid rain under control through this system. And then when I was in the Senate, I was able to use that and put it into the Clean Air Act. And so it became part of the national program. So you don't hear about acid rain now. We could do the same thing for climate change if we had the leadership that was willing to recognize the greatest market, the biggest market on this planet is the energy market. It is today. There are 4 to 5 billion users. They're going to be about 9 billion users in the next 30 years because that's going to be the population of the world. And we have the ability through the deployment of sustainable, renewable, alternative energy to be able to limit our emissions and control climate.
You write in your book that despite President Trump's rollbacks and attempts to roll back President Obama's signature climate and environmental policies, which you helped to create, you remain optimistic. Why?
Well, I am optimistic. I'll tell you why. First of all, because living without optimism would be miserable. I don't want to be miserable. But more importantly, because I see what's happened in my lifetime, which is what I write about in the book, Every Day is Extra. I mean, Every Day is Extra is a way to have respect for life itself and for our choices about what we do with each day. And because I was lucky enough with a bunch of friends to come back from a war alive and whole, I felt I had an obligation to use every day to its maximum. It was a gift. Other guys didn't get that gift. And I thought we owed it to them and their legacy, as well as to ourselves and our own value system, to live a life of purpose, to do something. So that's what I set out to do. And in fact, my book, which is very personal, it's not a Secretary of State policy book. It's a journey. It's the description of a personal journey and what I learned from it. And what I learned from it is we have every reason to be optimistic. Why? Because we're doing amazing things on this planet. We're breaking new barriers every day in terms of science, in terms of our understanding of things. We are living better. We have a higher standard of living, notwithstanding poor people and homeless, etc. We do have a higher standard of living. The severe poverty rate when I was in college was 50% of this world. Today, it's less than 10% for the first time in history. We brought 450 million people out of poverty in China, 400 million in India. 15 years ago, South Korea was an aid recipient country. Today, it's a donor country. So I see this transformation taking place. We're curing diseases we never thought we'd cure. Smallpox, tuberculosis, polio. I mean, we're doing an amazing job with cancer now, with the genome. We have an ability to give specialized cancer treatment. People are living longer, living better than that. So the challenge remains, but the ability to meet the challenge is absolutely clear to all of us. So that's what leaps out at me, is that technology will continue to improve life. People are going to live longer, I hope better. But we got to organize ourselves better. We're not making our democracy and our governance choice work effectively. And we've learned through history that the alternatives aren't pretty. We don't want to have a monarchy. We don't want to have a dictatorship. We don't want socialism or communism or whatever. I don't believe. I think democracy, our democracy has unleashed the greatest creativity, the greatest freedom. But people have to respect it by going out and voting. 54.2% is not acceptable. And I've been in parts of the world as an election observer in Sudan, in the West Bank, in Kenya, in the Philippines, where I've seen people come out and wait 15 hours of one day in the hot sun with tanks in some places and guns in the hands of people to vote. And I remember going up to a fellow in Sudan, they were waiting in the heat and the long line. And I said, look, I'm really sorry because I was an observer. And I said, I'm so sorry, the lines are long and you have to wait so long to vote. And he said, I've waited 50 years to vote. I'll wait whatever it is now that I'm in this line to vote. They will do that. Why don't we?
So what's your proudest accomplishment in terms of climate or the environment?
You know, I've been asked that and I have never reduced my public career to one accomplishment. I just don't do that. I can't do that. I'm proud of what I did on climate change, but I'm proud of the Iran nuclear deal that got rid of a nuclear weapon and the capacity to build one. I'm proud of getting chemical weapons out of Syria. I'm proud of what we did with AIDS in Africa, a program that Bill Frist and I actually started in the United States Senate. I'm proud of getting children's health care into the Senate health care bill. You know, I'm proud of holding Washington accountable, is what some of the things I write about in the book, with the exposure of the Contra, the Iran-Contra. And the lies that were taking place, and Noriega, whose money was coming from drugs, coming into the veins of our children in various cities here. Proud of what I did in the Middlesex DA's office. Proud of opposing the war. So I can't pick one of those things. It's been a continuum. It's been a life's journey. And there's more to come in the sense that, you know, I'm not going to stop being a citizen. I'm going to continue to fight for the things that make a difference.
So what's next for you?
Next, I'm going to stay involved. I can't tell you how or what I'll be doing. I'm working with the Carnegie Endowment for Peace, International Peace in Washington. Very pleased to be there to be helpful on some international conflict issues. I am teaching course as a fellow on global affairs at Yale University, and I'm teaching course on American power in the 21st century and the tools of diplomacy. And I was writing the book, which is pretty time-consuming. I'm doing a little bit of private sector business to pay the bills and do things. So, you know, I've got a pretty broad bandwidth right now that's getting filled up fast.
You know, if people pick up your book, they'll be surprised to see how talented you are as a writer. Put a nice narrative arc together for this.
Well, thank you. So I think it turned out okay.
So what's your secret?
Secret to what?
To writing something like this. It's so readable.
I think over the years, I've been learning how to communicate, how to paint a picture. And I've always done that, actually. When I went to Vietnam, I wrote a lot about what I was seeing and observing. I've always enjoyed writing, but I've never written that much in a personal way this way. I've written several other books, but they were policy books, and it's a very different kind of book. This book is personal. This talks about my faith, talks about my family, talks about my divorce, talks about, you know, growing up in a war and opposing a war and tough things, talks about losing the presidency of the United States by one state and how you turn around and come back from that. I got a really nice note from a guy who'd been running for office, and he lost. And he wrote me about how he had been reading my book about how I processed that loss and what I decided to do, and he's found it really helpful. That I love. I mean, that really means something to me.
John Kerry is a former Secretary of State, Democratic candidate for President of the United States, a five-term United States Senator from Massachusetts, and his new book is called Every Day is Extra. Secretary Kerry, thanks so much for taking the time with me today.
Thank you for great questions and a really nice conversation. Appreciate it.